This is Alexander Abelis, and I'm about to read to you an opinion piece that I wrote for CNN, published on 31 January 2017, just about a week after President Trump was inaugurated, and republished an anthology of essays entitled 1984 in the 21st Century. I'm an information security lawyer with the Blackstone Law Group in New York, though I started out in this field as a hacker in the mid-90s. And since then, I've worked in various defense components and within the intelligence community. I've also worked in information security and compliance in both New York and London. You can reach me on the web at blg.nyc and on Twitter at aurbelis. That's A-U-R-B-E-L-I-S. And now for the article, entitled, How 1984 Can Decode Trump's First 100 Days. Watching me read 1984 in high school, arguably the greatest dystopian novel ever written, my mother told me that it was a book that everyone should read not just once, but again, every 10 years. And it certainly deserves a reread right now. Indeed, dozens of news stories this week have alerted us to surging sales of George Orwell's 1984 since the inauguration, and even more so in the wake of Kellyanne Conway's now infamous alternative facts gambit. Most media outlets have reported glibly on the figures, with some going so far as to compare the Amazon bestseller list, where purchases of 1984 have gone up nearly 10,000%, to a political barometer, before making the obvious parallel between the Orwellian concepts of newspeak and doublethink and the words of Conway and actions of White House Communications Director Sean Spicer. Yet, surprisingly, very few have neither unpacked the full measure of the parallels between Orwell's dystopia and the Trump administration, nor the import of the Trump administration's practices so far, if left unchecked, as the protagonist of 1984, Winston Smith, was warned. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. If the sales figures tell us anything, it's that we are right to want a fuller account of the comparisons between literature's most infamous cautionary dystopia and a new American presidential administration. I believe we are treading into territories more treacherous than even Orwell himself contemplated. We now have a president and an administration in power that expects its own versions of reality and events to be created for it, a la carte, after the fact. This is not the first time in recent memory that sales of 1984 have spiked. In June 2013, Edward Snowden let the world know that the machinations of the U.S. surveillance apparatus were turned not only outward, but inward on a massive scale. But this new surge in popularity has a far more pernicious cause: the linguistic assault on and blatant disregard for the truth and rational thought by senior Trump administration officials and the president himself. We are now fighting a battle over who controls the very notion of what is real and fake, true and false, and we cannot afford to mince words. President Trump and his staff have used and will use lies and deceit to create a false perception of reality that suits their political agenda. They have espoused as truth unsupportable and untenable falsehoods on a daily basis, and it has become the near full-time responsibility of the media to call out the fictions of the administration. If we do not continue the struggle for basic honesty, we are warned by Orwell that uncorrected lies will be, quote, passed into history and become truth. What 1984 tells us about ourselves. 1984 is a menacing tale about the fictional state of Oceania. It exists in a state of continuous and seemingly never-ending war. Its institutions are notoriously revisionist and manipulative of public perception, with no regard for historical facts or truth. Overseeing law and order and guarding against even minor rebellion is overt and omnipresent government surveillance, and in the seat of power directing all functions of state is Big Brother, a cult of personality demanding of the most intense personal and political loyalty. May sound familiar. For me, however, 1984 has been more than a cautionary tale of dystopia. The concepts, characters, and lessons have in a real sense guided me both personally and professionally. My teenage years were spent as a hacker, frequently sneaking into Manhattan from Long Island to attend the infamous 2600 meetings, an underground monthly gathering of New York's hackers in the lobby of the Citigroup building. At the center of these meetings was the editor-in-chief of 2600, The Hacker Quarterly, Emmanuel Goldstein, whose nom de guerre was taken directly from their principal and likely fictitious enemy of the state in 1984. Emmanuel and I have a friendship spanning nearly 25 years now, and I still regularly contribute to his hacker-focused radio show and podcast, Off the Hook, airing weekly on WBAI in New York. As a teenager, I saw several friends from the circle of 2600 hauled off to prison. Their experiences cemented my desire to become a lawyer. In the midst of my first read of 1984, my mother surprised my sister and me with a puppy. A beautiful little black mutt abandoned at a groomer's office. This puppy was willful, forceful, and seemed always to be plotting against all attempts to exercise authority or dominion over him. He was the embodiment of Orwell's concept of thought crime, the criminal act of opposing the ruling party, so we named him Winston, after Winston Smith, in 1984. Winston remained steadfastly contrarian and by my side for 16 years, seeing me through high school, college, law school, and then real life. When Winston died in 2011, I began volunteering with a local New York City dog rescue, Mighty Mutts. And during one shift, I will never forget the most perfect beagle up for adoption jumped into my lap and refused to leave, as if pronouncing to the world that I was now hers. When I asked for her name, I couldn't believe my ears when I was told, Julia. The very name of Winston's counterpart in 1984, his kindred spirit and fellow outlaw, we adopted Julia immediately, and until she joined Winston over the Rainbow Bridge earlier this year, she took over his role as a daily reminder of the wisdom of 1984 and the very special place that novel holds in my heart. Orwell's lessons, cautions, and predictions have in my life never been more real and more serious than they are now. Those lessons and parallels merit serious consideration. Much has been written about Newspeak, the fictional language of Ocean, Iowa, with its deliberately limited and constantly diminishing vocabulary, and how its assaults on truth and reason parallel Trump administration practices. The idea behind Newspeak is that by reducing vocabulary, it is also possible to constrict personal thought and the freedom of expression. In Orwell's world, there is no such thing as the word bad. It is instead ungood. But could this very surface-level comparison between Newspeak and Conway's characterization of Spicer's blatant lies as, quote, alternative facts really be spurring such resurgence in the interest in 1984? Of course not. There is more. In everything from his cabinet appointments to the rationale for destabilizing executive orders, President Trump appears to have taken a cue directly from 1984's fictional ministries, whose purposes are diametrically opposed to their names. Orwell's Ministry of Truth, Minitrue, in Newspeak, for example, had nothing to do with truth, but was responsible for the fabrication of historical facts. In that vein, President Trump has provided us, in the name of security, with a travel ban on immigrants and refugees from countries whose citizens have caused the terrorism deaths of no Americans, while leaving out countries whose citizens have caused the terrorism deaths of thousands of Americans. He has provided us with Betsy DeVos, a Secretary of Education who is widely believed to oppose public education and who promotes the truly Orwellian-sounding concept of, quote, school choice, a plan that seems well-intentioned but which critics complain actually siphons much-needed funds from public to private educational institutions. Andy Pudser, named to head the Labor Department, which is charged with promoting and protecting the welfare of wage earners, has a checkered past with workers' rights and has actually praised the efficiency of robots over humans on account of automatons' inability to take vacation and file discrimination complaints. And we cannot fail to mention that Scott Pruitt, nominated to head the Environmental Protection Agency, which has responsibility to protect health and the environment, as Oklahoma Attorney General, devoted his office to battling the EPA, actively sought deregulation of air pollution requirements, and spearheaded the attack on Obama's efforts to reduce global warming, the Clean Power Plan. What is truly terrifying is that President Trump and his people refuse to recognize the contradictory nature of their positions, which is the condition perfectly described in 1984 as doublethink. Quote, to hold simultaneously two opinions which canceled out, knowing them to be contradictory and believing both of them, that is doublethink. And most germane, to tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just as long as it is needed, that is doublethink. Going hand in hand with the concept of doublethink was the notion of black-white, a loyal willingness to say that black is white when party discipline demands. Black-white, however, is more sinister in that it also means the ability to believe that black is white, to know that black is white, and to forget that one has ever believed to the contrary. We saw this firsthand when President Trump addressed staff members at the CIA. As he recalled his mental impressions of the inauguration crowd, he said, I looked out, the field was, it looked like a million. Million and a half people. And I don't think he was lying. I believe that President Trump believed this because he had to believe it. The revision of events one day prior to his speech was necessary because it was the only way he could assert legitimacy to control the present moment. The worst, however, is not that Conway and Spicer so easily and willingly followed suit with their own acts of black-white, but that they really believed that we, the media, and the people would in turn do the same. In a famous passage of 1984, large crowds gathered to denounce Oceania's long-standing rival, Eurasia. Mid-speech, a slip of paper is passed to the speaker, and mid-sentence, without batting an eyelid, the speaker changes the name of the enemy to Oceania's long-time ally, East Asia. With a simple act of black-white, foe was changed to friend, and friend to foe. And we are living in this state of flux in real life. Russia was, and likely is, our nation's fiercest rival. Yet as a candidate, President Trump famously stated, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 Clinton emails that are missing." He praises Putin, but states that perhaps he may not actually like him when they meet. WikiLeaks published DNC data alleged to have been obtained by Russian operatives, but the election wasn't rigged. A recount would be ridiculous, yet voter fraud was rampant. Trusted sources of information are now fake news, and somehow Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks' most notable whistleblower, is now an ungrateful traitor. Flying in the face of bipartisan condemnation of his delusional theory of voter fraud, President Trump has now vowed to launch a major investigation into the fictional fraudsters that cost him the popular vote. With such an Orwellian twist, perhaps we will all soon learn that the millions of elusive mystery voters registered under the name Emmanuel Goldstein. 1 week into Trump's presidency, the parallels with 1984 are more than surface level, and this portends an ominous future for the United States, regardless of your political persuasion. We, among the species, are gifted with language, with thought, with the ability to freely express every singular emotion we experience with sincerity and honesty. We have today what Winston and Julia of Orwell's dystopia lost, fought so hard to reclaim, and failed to achieve: free speech. At once cautionary and foreboding, certain passages of 1984 eloquently remind us to hold on to the ideals of truth and equality, because simple truths that bind us are stronger than complex lies that divide us. Orwell wrote, "It was curious to think that the sky was the same for everybody, in Eurasia or East Asia as well as here. And the people under the sky were also very much the same, everywhere, all over the world, hundreds or thousands of millions of people just like this. People ignorant of one another's existence, held apart by walls of hatred and lies, and yet almost exactly the same. A people who had never learned to think, but were storing up in their hearts and bellies and muscles the power that would one day overturn the world." Before Winston, my dog, passed away, I promised him that my firstborn son would carry his name. Loving that dog as much as I did, my kind wife allowed me to make good on that promise. Our son's middle name is Winston, and like the Winston and Julia that came before him, for me, his name is symbolic of the constant struggle against tyranny and for truth. I sincerely hope that every newly bought copy of 1984 is read through and through, and as my mother admonished, read again and again, because that novel shows that what is at stake right now is nothing short of the legitimacy, confidence, and honesty of our republic. If you're tuning in just now, this has been Alexander Abelis reading an opinion piece I wrote for CNN, published on 31 January 2017. I'm an information security lawyer, and you can reach me at blg.nyc on the web and at aurbelis, A-U-R-B-E-L-I-S, on Twitter. Thank you so very much for listening, and thank you for supporting Pacifica Radio.